are in Boston at the Sheraton. This is the headquarters for the next frontier of the Brain Forum, imagining the next decade of neuroscience, research and development. It's also called One Mind for Research. And sitting opposite me is the current provost of Harvard for about another 33 days, I believe.
36 days, 3 hours.
And counting. Steve Hyman, welcome back. It's nice to see you again. Tell me what your role was in organizing this and setting it up and why.
Well, this is a really wonderful event, and I somehow got kidnapped into organizing the symposium and writing the plan. It's a joke to say I was kidnapped, but I have a more than full-time day job right now. I was approached by Patrick Kennedy and Garen Staglin, and I think they had a really fabulous idea, which was that at a time when so many areas of science are in retrenchment mode, worried about U.S. federal budgets, worried also about declining foundation budgets because of endowment troubles, and so forth, they both had the strong view that the neuroscience community had to be proactive, driven, of course, by the moral and practical need to make more rapid advances in brain disorders, ranging from the disorders of childhood that impair human capital formation to the looming crisis posed by Alzheimer's disease. And so I signed on, and I think at the time I did, neither I nor they knew exactly what the scope of this was going to be, but we've ended up with a wonderful two-day scientific meeting and then a meeting at the Kennedy Library to commemorate the 50th anniversary of JFK's announcement of a moonshot. And we had a great meeting today. The goal of the meeting was to highlight progress and promise in neuroscience with a view toward creating a shared 10-year plan that might drive funding.
And there is there's a 16-page
yes.
version of it.
Yes.
There's also a 62-page version
yes.
on
yes.
the on
yes.
the One Mind for
yes.
Research
yes.
website.
Yes, absolutely.
And it starts by saying, document makes three key points. Neuroscience has made remarkable strides, yet gains in diagnosis, treatment of brain disorders remain hard won because of the extraordinary challenges of understanding human brain. That's one. Two, staggering global toll of brain disorders urgently demands effective solutions, and the cost of inaction would prove staggering. And three, it's time for investment and concerted effort, powerful new tools emerging, coherent approach to the problem. And those are the three,
Roger, you've
three
got
points,
it exactly right.
3 points.
Yes, those are the three main points that I think we had to make today and that we have to make to advocates and supporters. The first thing to be said is neuroscience is very hard. I mean, the brain supports this conversation, but it supports, you know, poetry and love and building skyscrapers like the one we're in and war, as we've just heard about in thinking about traumatic brain injury, mm-hmm. and all of the incredible subtle panoply of things that we do as human beings, including the fact that we can record this conversation and post it on the web. And any organ that underwrites all of those capacities has got to be terribly complicated. So to decipher what's really going on in the brain with its thousands of cell types that expresses 80% of our genomes and that has layered on top of the molecules and cells 100 trillion connections between those cells formed into complex neural circuits. This is a very hard job indeed, and if we didn't stipulate that, we would be at risk of overpromising or overclaiming, and then we would lose our credibility. But despite that difficulties, despite those challenges, I think the second point is that the urgency of brain disorders absolutely commands our attention for reasons of compassion for sufferers, but also for very clear-eyed economic reasons. We now know, now that we have methodologies, not ideal, but methodologies to understand how disease causes disability, we recognize that brain disorders are the leading causes of disability in the world, and certainly far and away in developed countries where the old scourges of infectious disease are more or less under control. And this is not surprising, because the brain, after all, again, is the substrate of our ability to think, to control our behavior. And so sickness of the brain is clearly going to damage our capacity to learn when we're young, to engage usefully as citizens. So again, in a really clear-eyed view of this, we want to turn people who are, because of brain disorders, dependent or underperforming, into effective members of society, literally turn them into taxpayers.
You're also a neurobiologist, obviously,
yes, yes.
At Harvard,
yes.
Harvard School of Medicine. Do you see this as an enormous challenge? One can make an argument about
yes.
genetics, for
yes,
example,
yes.
and
yes.
that almost
yes.
seems like a simple
yes. Absolutely.
problem in
sure.
comparison to
very. I mean, genetics, as unutterably complex as it is,
yeah.
is a more defined, more mature field. So I think the argument can be made, or the question can be asked, well, why now? You know, the burden of brain disorders has certainly come into clearer view. The problem is certainly more threatening as we age as a population, and neurodegenerative disorders, most notably Alzheimer's, Parkinson's, other forms of dementia, loom larger and larger. But still, why should we invest now? Because you've already stipulated, or I've already stipulated, that it is so challenging. And I think the answer about what is different really has to do with very powerful new tools and new modes of organization in science. So we've mentioned genetics, and in truth, the genetics of many brain disorders, especially the neuropsychiatric disorders, autism, schizophrenia, bipolar disorder, major depression, I could go on and on. The genetics turn out to be fiendishly complex. There are many, many genetic pathways to disease risk. There are many, many genes involved. But modern genomic technologies are finally giving us a toehold in what used to be a featureless landscape, right, without clues. And the results of this will literally be clues pointing us into the neurobiology. I mean, the goal is to take what we learned from genetics and turn it into neurobiological experiments that can ultimately point the way toward therapies, dare I say, even cures. You know, a second whole set of tools has to do with understanding these brain circuits that are, in many ways, what underlies our behavior, our thinking, our emotions. And right now, we don't have a good wiring diagram. But again, mm-hmm. and this was clear in a marvelous panel today in the symposium, we have at the level of animals really exciting new ways of understanding, of charting circuits, and even more exciting to understand their function. I mean, this new technology of optogenetics allows us to control particular cell types within a circuit and see what they're doing. And from the point of view of human beings, of course, ethically and pragmatically, we're not going to do invasive experiments on human beings. But non-invasive neuroimaging is moving ahead extraordinarily rapidly. And it's the combination, literally across disciplines, between this exciting animal work and cellular work and human, you know, neuroimaging and other non-invasive kinds of, what let's call it, human experimental neurobiology, that are providing, again, a whole new set of platforms upon which we can create, I think, enormous progress.
Yeah, we spoke to earlier today to Mark Raichel and to Carl Deisseroth.
Right. So you're well aware of... Right.
But on the other hand, the other person on that panel, you remember, Jeff Lichtman,
yes.
showed elaborate
yes.
detail down at
yes.
the synaptic level,
yes.
put it all together
yes.
and said,
right.
it's worthless because we don't know what's happening beyond that scale. It's
well,
it was a funny moment.
It was a funny moment, but what he meant was... with more investment and better tools, we will convert what is now a pilot experiment
yeah.
into a wiring diagram, ultimately, of a human being. And I think that will be an extraordinarily valuable tool, since, after all, most of the subtle symptoms that occur in brain disorders have to do with the disruption of circuit function.
Yeah. I mean, this is a very very ambitious program. I mean, we've been through perception, been through the connectome, mapping the brain, genetic revolution. There was a symposium on neurobiological consequences of war. Then there's emotion and motivation, learning and memory, movement. You must have had a lot of help in thinking a lot of this through.
Oh, yeah, of course. I mean, there was...
Star-studded cast on the back of this.
Yes, yes, page. There was enormous help from... the Society for Neuroscience and its leadership, and also from the leadership of the NIH institutes
yeah.
that support neuroscience, and many other individuals. And I think what you see as the product is it's like our highlights reel. You know, if this were a sports show, you'd be seeing compelling exemplars of the fruits of prior investment and hope for the future in creating a 10-year plan for neuroscience. So, you know, we chose vision, we could have chosen hearing, we could have chosen other forms of sensation, but what we're able to do with vision is to show the first successes of gene therapy in restoring sight for somebody with Mendelian, that is, single gene disorder that had caused congenital blindness. And we didn't even get to talk about artificial retinas, which is a very important example of mm-hmm. brain-machine interfaces. When we, you know, talked about the connectome, we presented these exciting new tools and platforms upon which all kinds of progress will be made. And you know, I think it's important to recognize how much of a difference tools and technologies make. You know, I, like everyone else, would want to believe that it's only my clever ideas that move science forward. But the truth is that tools and technologies make all the difference and allow us to imagine what we can do beyond. And I'm very fond of the example, because it's so clear, of advances in optics that allowed Galileo's, through improved telescope, to see the four moons of Jupiter that he first identified and forever changed our conception of the universe, or that permitted Leeuwenhoek to see capillaries or to begin to see microorganisms and also vastly expand human knowledge. And as clever as these men were, it was the tools that allowed them to make these advances. And I think that's really part of what marks this as a time when we can make a real push in neurobiology. It is this panoply of new tools across many domains, genetics, imaging, connectomics, new approaches to chemical screening for compounds, new understandings driven by new tools for understanding gene expression and epigenetics and so on and so on. It's really exciting. And underlying a lot of this are advances in computation. That's what is allowing us to amass and analyze amounts of data that previously would be unthinkable. And that's also, in many ways, what is permitting us to organize ourselves in completely new ways. Now, there's no war between big science and small science. We're going to continue always to have small labs that are actually going to benefit from large databases and platforms. It's going to make their lives easier and change the questions they can ask. But without computation above all and these new tools, we were forced to define the problem size that we could address as something that could be done by a small number of people, you know, like me and a graduate student in 2 years or 3 years. Mm-hmm. And because of these computational tools, you know, we can dream of, before too long, sequencing the chromosomes of thousands of people with schizophrenia or autism and comparing those with healthy people. And that was just not something we could even imagine not very long ago. And the same in connectomics. Mm. It's literally the amounts of data that will need to be stored and analyzed, which is critical. And the other thing that's happened is we can share this data publicly. We should share it publicly because there's going to be so much that's so exciting that no one team or group can possibly analyze it all. And I think what we've learned is that while, of course, people who work hard to gather data, do experiments, do deserve a period of exclusivity, in the end, by sharing it, it can be utilized to produce much of great importance to everyone. And I hope that that no one after a day like this can imagine that their goal is to have their data buried with them as if they were a pharaoh at the end of their career.
I mean, there are names of, you were a former director, of course, of a national institute yourself, mental health, but I mean, there are names on here of the directors of several institutes. Francis Collins gave a talk, mm-hmm. was here. What kind of official status does this prospect have? I mean, does it?
Well, it's interesting. It's not
in the administration.
Yeah, it's a good question. I think part of the reason so many people contributed was because it was owned by many communities, both practicing neuroscientists in many universities around the country and NIH, people from pharmaceutical companies, people from biotech, individuals at foundations, independent institutes like the Alan Brain Institute, mm-hmm. Which are supported philanthropically, that are producing, you know, tools and data and reagents that are available broadly and publicly, which is what's exactly right. And the status of the document is really one of persuasion, it's not the official consensus of a part of the government or of any society. I think that's healthy. We have to make this as absolutely persuasive as possible, and we have to get people bought in. We can't take anything for granted. That's what's going to make this this plan, this set of approaches, as deeply entrenched and as strong as they need to be to warrant really significant investment at a time when there is financial pressure, right? We need to convince people that if we don't do something about Alzheimer's, this is what I meant about the cost of inaction, if we can't delay the onset of Alzheimer's disease by 5 years or 10 years, let alone prevent it entirely or cure it, the consequences are going to eat us alive in terms of taking caregivers out of the workforce, in terms of the costs of taking care of the members of my baby boom generation, mm-hmm. who can no longer attain self-care. And the argument is, you know, at this point, with the right kind of investment, we can actually dream of doing that, right? It's precisely a non-traditional collaboration among government and industry and universities and the Foundation for the NIH that has produced biomarkers. There's this Alzheimer's disease neuroimaging initiative, which is this consortium I'm talking about, that has produced biomarkers that no one group could have arrived at or could have mm-hmm. afforded. That's going to make it affordable, feasible to do the kinds of clinical trials we're going to have to do. But we must invest. We can succeed. I don't want to oversell. It's hard, right? I don't want to pretend that any of this is guaranteed. But there's more than enough to go on. And I think a document like this, created as it has been, can contribute to this sense of urgency and the need to invest.
Yeah, I asked you a question last time we talked, but let me ask you it again. You're having now gone through the experience of this and so on. That was the question about when the administration came in. He said you would restore science to its rightful mm-hmm. place.
Yes.
What do you think the rightful place of science is?
Well, I think before I answer it personally, maybe one of the best things I can do is refer to the spirit of President Obama's words about the role of science. I mean, he calls it winning the future, but in some sense, that's exactly right. If we fail to invest, he of course phrased it in terms partly of American competitiveness, but even thinking globally, if we fail to invest in areas that are ripe, that influence our ability as human beings to be effective in this world, dare I say, even to be happy in this world, like investments in neuroscience, we will face extremely damaging consequences. You know, we can't sit still. The world population continues to grow. We are headed toward perhaps 9 or 10 billion people. We are living in a world partly because of the revolution in communications and because of transportational systems that exist that create enormous pressures on societies, on families, on individuals. We have defeated or at least delayed old lethal scourges so that people are living longer and mm-hmm. more is expected of them. Science and, of course, its effective and ethical application to a whole host of human issues, including health, notably health, is in some sense an important route to human flourishing. And without it, we are going to be in a very diminished world. Right? I mean, we're not in a stable population situation. We're not in a stable climate situation and so forth. Science is a pragmatic and I would say a moral necessity. And those people who, it's fine to have arguments, of course, we should all sort of disagree about methodologies and the collection of facts and so forth. But those people who denigrate the scientific method too frequently for political reasons are damaging the human future, and maybe even in a nearer term than they think for their immediate gain of whatever kind it is.
It says here on the Wikipedia page, I've just noticed the answer to my own question, which is that you announced that you'll be leaving your position as provost of Harvard at the end of the 2010-11 academic year. You were then going to do a year-long sabbatical at the Broad Institute at Harvard and MIT. At some point, he plans to create a new course offering on the implications of neuroscience for philosophy, ethics, policy, and law.
Yes. Well, so I'm...
When did you have that idea?
Well, I've actually been teaching intermittently such a course to Harvard undergraduates, but given my day job as university provost, which is the chief academic officer, but lots of other things on top of it, I think I've taught this course from a platform of exhaustion and written my lectures from hypnagogic states. So I'd really like to have time to be more thoughtful about the materials. But there's so many exciting issues that raise ethical and policy issues. We heard about some of them today. We heard about cognitive enhancement, not only to treat dementia, but also to improve the outcome of exposure therapies for post-traumatic stress disorder. But surely cognitive enhancement used by people who are less ill or who are healthy raises all kinds of important ethical and policy issues. We're going to hear tomorrow about social cognition and, again, pharmacologic agents or other ways of manipulating the way we interact with others, whether it is our trust or any other of our moral emotions, again, raises profound issues for how we think of ourselves as human beings. So I'm very excited about having time to teach such a course. But my main activity next year, after 10 years in academic administration, and before that 6 years as NIMH director, is to see whether I can be usefully cognitively rehabilitated as a scientist, or whether, you know, I'd better find something else to do. I never intended to be predominantly administrative for so long, but you don't want to hear my my long tale. It's been interesting. It's been worth it. But now it's time to see whether I still have enough neuroplasticity to return to science in a way that is truly useful.
I suppose that's what you're optimistic about then.
It's what I'm hopeful about, some admixture of anxiety.
All right, it was great to talk to you again.
And you.
Thanks.
Good.
Bye.